It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. And in today's conversation, we're going to be talking about the ways natural science and poetry both involve attentive observation and the careful study of the natural world. And through the simplicity of poetry, our guest can reveal the complexity of the universe. We'll discover how poets can help make science more accessible to a wider audience, expand our awareness of and appreciation of the natural world, and hopefully encourage us to support sustainability initiatives. It's all about taking the time to look and appreciate the wonders that surround us. And with us for today's conversation is Ronald H. Fenn, a poet, nature observer, and educator. Welcome, Ron.
Thank you, Mark, for being here.
Great.
Very happy to be here.
So this is, for me, a real thrill. So obviously this is radio, but we're sitting outside overlooking a beautiful pond area, and that has a... behind it, a conservation area. And this must be so inspiring for you to be able to sit here and see and then write.
It is, Mark. It's quite amazing. I mean, when you take just this small portion of Earth here on Cape Cod, this region, this area with this coastal plain pond, and forest, it's quite revealing, and you begin to discover such intricate dynamics to wildlife, plant life, and human life in this area. It's such a harmony and balance of these, and sometimes it's discord. All of those events take place, but for myself here at my home, I'm able to witness nature through the different species that I do see, either birds, mammals, fish, and amphibians. So it's just a wonderful experience.
So you have an interesting background in that you were a math teacher for a long time, right, in high school level?
High school, college, mostly. College professor.
Okay. And where did poetry come along?
Oh, it came in right at the beginning.
Okay.
Yeah, it was always in the beginning. When I was 16, I actually wrote a short story that was a hybrid of... Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's, one of his stories, with taking into balance some type of idea of history. And that's what I put together at that time and then rewrote it recently, but didn't finish it and realized that I'm certainly not a short story writer or a novelist.
So, have you always been curious about the natural world?
Oh,
is that where it started?
Yes.
As well as the poetry, but I mean, is that just looking and seeing?
Yeah, I think mostly, yes, as a child growing up in woodland areas and so forth, and using the imagination in youth, that energy in youth, bringing it out into the natural world, you begin to see what's out there, and that those stimuli create this unitive experience with the person, especially a child. So that's the growth. And then as I got older, I started reading Thoreau. Thoreau is probably the greatest influence on me in terms of nature. His last page in Walden is probably the best nature prose ever written. So I recommend that to everybody.
Yeah. And so, as a child, did you live in a place you could be outside?
Yes. Yeah, it was middle class, suburban, but forested around where I was able to walk and discover things with my friends. And, of course, imagine different games we could play in nature and so forth. And then even things such as kite flying. We had a large open field, and we'd take our kites down to the field. And I'd always wonder about updrafts in the wind. And the wind began to sort of speak to you. It speaks to you by flying that kite, because you're connected to the wind through the string, through the kite, through imagination. And that all gets transferred into some meaningful way. And for me, it began very early on with a journal. So I started my journal due to Emerson and Thoreau. And coming from New England here, Emerson mentioned to Thoreau, he said, "Do you keep a journal?" And as soon as I read that question, it triggered in me to begin. So at that point, now I'm 16 volumes later into my journal, about 10 to 12 literary works, and much of it poetry, different collections of poetry.
Yeah, and I've had the real advantage of being able to see at least a couple of your journals. I've seen the collection. But as I look through them, one of the things I think our listeners would love to know is that you use this, you almost change voice in the writing. It's funny. It's not only in the words that you use, but I also noticed pen color changes. You go from cursive to print. You do different things. And so talk more about that. That whole way that you do a journal is really, really nice.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it is quite different from what I've seen, because most people, I definitely make a connection, as I have in my journal entries years ago, between head and hand, and how it's quite magical to connect the two and align the two in terms of what one wants to express. So when it comes to prose writing, it will be, and I always prefer, instead of being at the computer first, I'm at my journal, and it's all handwriting. So it's longhand. And then at times, as you say, it can change to calligraphy. And that calligraphy comes in normally when there is an idea that is arising, some seed of poetic origin. And that absolutely takes hold of my thinking, and whatever courses out of my mind, out of my imagination, it's written in calligraphy. So I do have that. So those are the two main: handwriting, longhand, and calligraphy. But you do bring up an important point, is that there is this transformation. Perhaps the calligraphy has to do with the fact of focusing on what I'm doing, but relaxed in doing it. So a state of restful alertness in creativity.
Yeah, I love that phrase, restful alertness. Can you elaborate more on where that comes from?
Oh, yeah.
Because I know you're interested in Eastern kinds of thoughts.
Yeah, well, that does come from Eastern meditation. Actually, it comes from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who founded the Science of Creative Intelligence, the Transcendental Meditation Program, which I became a teacher and governor of, and meditate today based on Transcendental Meditation Technique. So it does come from that tradition, that phrase. It's a beautiful phrase, because Vedic science is the inner science. It's the subjective science to our wonderful, rational, observing, phenomenal science. And when we tie these two together, it fuses the nexus of consciousness or awareness, simple human awareness, with human intellect, reason, logic, imagination, art, science, and community all fused together, that is the wellspring for poetry. That's why poetry, I always think of like becoming a scotch drinker. It takes time. You know?
Yeah, you have to develop the...
You have to labor over
the labor over it.
Until it's no longer labor.
I love that. You know, that's really great. I know that when many of the poets, and I don't know how you feel about this, but many of the poets that I've talked to, there is a whole art of simplicity to poems. In other words, you try to say in as few words, but as most to having the most impact that you can with the words as possible, what's thinking. And it's a little different than prose because you really are trying to get to the essence of what it is you want to say. Am I right on your work, too?
Oh, you're absolutely right, Mark, in my opinion. That is absolutely true. In fact, in mathematics, I did my dissertation on mathematical problem solving, an aesthetic approach to process. Huh. And defined in throughout that whole original paper was the fact of looking at simple elegance in mathematical theory, theoretical writing. And this is what I think was a generator for me that I saw in Taoism as the law of least resistance and the watercourse way of Alan Watts, his term. It is do less, accomplish more. And that efficiency is exactly what's in science, what's in the arts, as you said. It's that concentrated genius that arises to the foreground and demonstrates itself through that player, that actor, the musician, the poet, the instructor, the scientist in their lecture, that opens us up to a whole world of inquiry.
So did it get you, now that makes me think, the mathematics, you know, a lot of times that's the language of science to describe also, right?
Yes.
To be able to describe what you're seeing, pattern, shape, form, repetition, right? And so now it makes perfect sense to me that you would be both, that you would do the prose and the math, and that you'd be excited about both.
Yes, yeah, that's so true. You know, I've been approached on that many times, people thinking an anomaly, the fact that one would be a mathematician or science in science, and at the same time, and by the way, I would not call myself truly a mathematician.
No, but that's
a mathematics teacher.
Teacher, but still,
yeah, you
still
had a mathematician. You're creative.
You still had a PhD.
Oh,
in
yeah.
it, so we'll count that.
Close to that. And so it involves that kind of distinctive characteristic of saying the economy of life, the economy of thought. And that's how poetry arises, because poetry, as I mentioned, is that most distinctive language we could speak in. As you mentioned, prose is more involved. It involves somebody, where poetry is the essence of what we're going to be involved with.
Okay.
So in other words, it has a quid pro quo in terms of the law of least action. And by that I mean, when you listen to poetry, that's the passive act or the inward stroke of the activity. But when you start internalizing it and ask questions, as you fabulously do.
Thank you.
It's very special because now it's been internalized. And here it is presenting itself either to the poet in terms of a question or somebody asking me to reread the poem. Or what about this? What did you mean by this? And I explain to them, I say, well, this is just my meaning, you know, whether I'm right or wrong. Your meaning is your meaning on it. But if you want to hear mine, I'm glad to share it. It's nothing special to it. But yours is, because you're internalizing it. So in a sense, Mark, the listener becomes the poet, and that is the outward stroke of listening to poetry. That's why meditation is not passive. Sazen is not passive. Transcendental meditation is not passive. It has the inward stroke and outward stroke of awareness of consciousness, which precedes, as the Dalai Lama said in a recent interview with Alan Lightman, that he saw consciousness as distinct from science itself. Not that it was outside of science, but it imbued science with the ability to have that creative intelligence and the ability for us as human beings to employ our logic and our reason, our theories, and be able to develop argumentation based on it and validation and verification of our work.
You know, it's really interesting when I know some of the scientists I know, there is this need to simplify, just as you're talking about in your poetry as well. And we always get this elegant solution idea or beauty.
Yes.
You hear it in mathematics all the time.
Oh, yes.
There's beauty, there's elegance.
Yes.
And when you're then using that and you're looking at the natural world, you're seeing these kinds of things that have to do what you're talking about, have to take you somewhere else in your mind.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure this has been the worn out anecdote, but when you look at Einstein's theory on relativity, his specific formula E equals mc squared, you have to ask, wow, we can concentrate Newtonian physics into this understanding of energy, of understanding the energy of light as a constant in masses of objects, which are themselves energy, and therefore you have this amazing nuclear vision of who and what we are, unbeknownst to us at its most refined levels, but all the more entertaining, amazing, and inviting to our curiosity.
Yeah, and you think of, you mentioned Einstein, you think specifically of that he did a lot of those mind things where he was mind imaging, and he created a way of being able to see what was mathematical and complex, partly probably because we know a little bit about him that he was great at math, but that wasn't his love. And so his love was the thought experiments and the ideas in his brain. And so he would, more than almost anybody I know of that era, could describe these incredibly complicated things in ways that we might at least begin to get a grasp of something.
Yeah, that's so true. You know, the fact of, I think genius involves that, where, as you just saying, the almost inscrutable becomes manifest to us as if we thought of it. We listen to a great profound fact, and we understand that this is a discovery that was always right before our eyes, and here it is. Oh, yeah. Oh, I had that experience. You know, not necessarily energy equals, you know, mc squared, but nonetheless a thought process visually done, a thought experiment. Not only that, but a life experience and experiment. Thoreau always said, you know, heal yourselves, physicians. Heal yourselves, and look at yourself as your own art. Hmm. Your ability to shape yourself as your own art. That was very profound. That deeply affected me, you know, in terms of my youth and understanding that you must push outward and also integrate it inwardly. And also understand the origins of what is inside of your awareness at all levels, affective level, intellectual level, creative level. Creativity is a real trip, a real something to behold, because creativity, I remember Edward de Bono, the sort of financial guru years ago, talking about the fact that creativity is based on humor. You have to have humor, otherwise you're not creative. This was his statement. And that's quite a profound thought. You realize that humor is not something serious. It's something that is light because you are able to integrate yourself with it. If it's too serious, there's a standoffish. And that's the problem with perception of different things, whether it be in our political world today, here in America or elsewhere. It doesn't allow that affinity, that glue, that prenatal glue to be there and connect us.
Wow. You know, you brought up Edward de Bono, who is I'm a really big fan of.
Oh.
And part of what you were just saying, and I would recommend any of our listeners to get one of his thinking skills books.
Yes.
But in one of them, we're all used to doing the comparison work of pros versus cons for decision making. He goes way beyond that, and he added the what he called the I to that. So there's positive, negative, so it's a P and I. And he found that most of life and decisions were in the I, which is interesting.
Yes.
And so it was what's more curious and is not good or bad, that you don't evaluate that, that actually is the most revealing.
Absolutely. In fact, that's how I taught for the decades that I did teach, now retired 2 years on, in just that. That's that curiosity. De Bono is tapping into the curiosity that's there. That's why it's so important for the educator to be able to draw out students' curiosities. And they'll be of all different sorts. They need to approach it in their own way. And if they're dedicated, you know, people who are good educators dedicated to it, they will find that the greatest reward.
Yeah, I mean, that makes just perfect and infinite sense with that. So thinking about when you sit, how do you go about writing? I mean, what all of a sudden makes you put something onto paper?
Well, it could come from a variety of stimuli. It will originate, say, sometimes in a word that I may read or a phrase. It may be poems, a haiku I may read. It may be a certain line that just triggers something. Or my muse, W.S. Merwin. William produced many, many books on poetry. He was our poet laureate 2010-2011. And particularly, he was one of the few scant books of poetry very early on in my life in my library, because I wanted to focus on my own origination of poetry. I was familiar with Whitman and the Lake Country poets, you know, in England and so forth. And it just required that kind of new transition. So one stimulus for me may be a triggered word. And that will all of a sudden set into mind a whole process going on that is almost effortless. It's very easy for me to write the first draft. It comes out almost in stanzas. I do free verse now. Over the past, since Merwin's death in 2019, I began collections of short poems. And I'm into volume 5 now, 700 poems on.
Wow.
And particularly they're free verse.
Okay.
And they're short. They're a page long.
So I want to go back just a second. So what is a muse, and what does it mean to have one?
Huh. Good question. Well, the muse will tie into, again, your first question. It's sort of, you know, just it draws back on that other question. And that is, the muse is what you find in your life as inspiring. It can be nature, as it is for me and much of my poetry. It can be in the writings of others or the lives of others, such as Merwin or Thoreau. And that muse is that creative spark. The one stimulus I mentioned to you, I don't want to shortchange you on this.
No, you're fine.
But in terms of triggering of a word or phrase, there's more. It could be a situation where I'm taking my morning walk and in nature, and it may be the hoot of an owl. But it's not the hoot of the owl that catches me. It's the echo that I'm getting, that I could hear in the rustling leaves where I'm at. It's that booming sound, the muffled sound. And all of a sudden, that creates its own poem. So the muse has been the owl, great horned owl, or, you know, the saw-whet owl. Okay, and that just catches my mind. It triggers something, and boy, you know, like most poets say, and writers say, you got to get it down because you're going to lose it. So,
yeah, and I hear, you know, from my friends that are scientists, I hear the same thing. And that's interesting. You just got to capture it.
Yeah, you.
The thing flew in there, you know, in front of their eyes, or they had this idea, and they couldn't work. They might work inordinate hours. But they had to capture it when it was in that phrase.
There's endless, to me, there's almost endless energy, inexhaustible energy. Once you have collected that, that's all you can do. It's like one of my friends say, Ron, you know, when you're into your writing, from what I know of it and what I've heard of it, it's almost like you're a machine. You know, it's ex machina. And, you know, it's just amazing. And I find it true that you are into that zone. You're into that stream of consciousness, that fertile field of creative intelligence that allows you to bring forth that which was, in a sense, gifted to you. Because it is a gift. It's not something, you know, you knew from its origin. It's a gift. Yeah. And poetry is that. That's why I think when we say, oh, that person's gifted, I think that's not, that's more common than we think amongst all of us. It's there in most people. It's just that we narrow it because of either our lack of experience in seeing it just in others, creating an abyss and not that connectivity between us and the person who is doing it and how they're being stimulated by it, when they themselves can resolve the same.
Yeah, and what you're saying in there is that we all know that before age five or whatever, children really don't discriminate that they can't do something.
Right.
In other words, I can't dance. No, they don't even think about it.
Yeah.
And they begin, society begins to model it. But you said something that's profound, I think, and that is on the other side of it, sometimes it's because we don't think, we don't have enough skill or enough knowledge about it, and so we don't think we can get there. Right. Instead of saying, oh, wow, I saw that out there. I'm on a quest. Right. Mm-hmm. That's the muse.
Yes.
And spending the time.
Yes.
And it's the time to get there.
Yes.
Right. And that's what you're really what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you there is that amazing balance between what may come effortless to you as a gift, but what you must take and run with.
Yeah.
You have to create whatever it is that's going to come forth.
Wow.
It's amazing. Creativity is such a humorous process.
Yeah, that's great. I've been talking with our guest, Ron Fenn, about the ways natural science and poetry both involve attentive observation, careful study of the natural world. Please join us for more conversation after a short break.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artist Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation with our guest, Ron Fenn, about the ways the simplicity of poetry can reveal the complexity of the universe. And, Ron, I know you have a poem to share with us. Would you do that?
Oh, I'd be glad to, Mark. Yeah. Yeah, I thought since we brought up, Japanese poetry in particular, I'd like to share with you one of my recent poems, and this is from Volume 5, and this is not haiku, but it's in that oriental vein, and I think people will understand. It's titled After My Heart. Where do 5 and 70 years go? I born out of the history of time will pass as unborn as every other. As moon glows and sinks over western horizon, floating clouds now ease the day, beginning and ending in each other. As thrush knows its song in territory and love, what becomes of those who lose its refrain? But a grain of dust will remain the same, adrift between the earth and sky. I see east, yet wander west.
Wow. It's just really beautiful, and I always love when somebody... I think poetry is meant to be read, particularly by the poet a lot of times, because the cadence, all those things are there. You want to read another one?
Sure, I'd love to. Yeah, this one has to do with our herring runs on Cape Cod here, where I'm located, and one special spot I love to go to. And this poem was recent, just on April 27th. It's titled Herring Headwaters. Each in their hour of little cold stream, below resonant returning light, seeking quick moving shadows near mineral translucent bottom, each striving fin and waving tail, silent below from churn of cold current, caressing and careening each rock, shoals of past year's journey, returning from ocean to bay to beginning with unfinished business. Lives begotten, then betaken, in spring's birthing and burying, with serene, soon summer pool.
You have one more did you want to do, share?
Sure.
For right now, and then we'll talk about them.
Dawn of new spring, accented by the rising fresh sunlight, with periods of breeze to each sentence, bud-filled branches of swamp maple fan to and fro as gentle gestures of welcome to this new spring day, or fragrant clusters of plum petals flower in an island of sheltered view, a thick thundercloud of pinkish purple that mother would have worn on Sundays, congregating in modest attraction with prayers. There is a grandest of movement in every living thing, not hesitating to be admired, but to each moment, freshly formed and true to test of time, returning ground, churning up its mineral scent, a mobile montage of a world in miniature, affirming each silver of dawn with break sliver anew. Across crawling, verdant, turning grasslands, harmonizing discordant sounds, immurmuration meant for the season. No single event is left untouched. In each celebrant of sensible spring, listening to the colors of flowers, emerging sight past blind silence of another season, another age.
Wow, you've been listening with me to Ronald Fenn, our poet, some of his poetry. It's unbelievable. Ron, when I listen to that, and I just get this sense of way more than just observing nature. There's another level of things that are happening in the poetry that has to be part of what's going on in you.
Yes.
How would you describe that experience for you when you read it and when you wrote it? Are they different? How is it?
It's a very good question, Mark. I think, again, I just speak on my behalf on this. And to tell you the real truth, I don't know. So I'm about to make a conjecture on that for you. And that is that when you talk about, we know that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And this is what entails the poet. The poet is writing what's on paper, but of course it's based on experience. And that experience comes forth through the writing, the whole sequence of creative steps into the auditorium, with the audience to hear the poet's words. And those words become verse. And when it becomes verse, it becomes a unitive experience where that whole, being greater than the sum of its parts, is aggregated. It's all brought together. So, in a sense, it has this holistic importance that is a transmission to all of us. Nature transmits to us its unitive beauty. So to me, it's unity. And in fact, one collection of poetry I have, which is more formal, years ago, one of my three major volumes is called Unity, and it is based on that. So I think it's like different states of consciousness, and we can understand only where we're at. We need to let go, be receptive for that passive inward stroke of what we're hearing, like the beautiful bird songs now before us here. And then the outward stroke. So that's adding to that viability, that truth, the very similitude of that total experience.
This description of the inside and the outside, and then I look at I was just asking you about, you're looking out at nature and you're looking in at yourself. And then you talked about your first works being a series on unity. It sounds to me like what you're saying is that what we should strive for as humans, or are trying to strive for, is the unity between the voices inside and the voices outside.
Absolutely, Mark. In fact, you just triggered the key word for me on this: connectivity.
Yeah.
Connectivity is exactly what we need. And connectivity involves our natural world, and we are animals of the natural world. We happen to be the alpha species, but nonetheless, it is a world that we are a part of, to learn from, to contribute to, and not only to ourselves and our humanity, but in our culture, in our civilization. It requires that kind of connectivity to truly listen to others, whether they be people, whether it be on politics, unfortunately, whether it be in nature alone. The interesting question is, why do we always find, most of us, relief when we're alone in nature? Or if we're with people, say on a guided, not a guided tour, but with friends in nature, say in the Rocky Mountains or in the American Southwest, in desert country, how do we find this solace, this serenity, this peace, and say, oh, I'm so refreshed. It's like I've taken a mental bath, a physical bath, even though I've done so much work here, you know, or forest bathing that we hear. It's the same thing. And all that is part of that rejuvenation of what is connectivity, because it recycles itself.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm fond of saying when I take people on a nature art walk, of saying that you don't see very many right angles, geometric figures in nature. You mostly see curves. And so it has to be a little difficult when you live in a very urban area. And I must explain then why people try to soften it with planting shrubs or trees or pots out front with flowers. There must be this draw that we have to take us away from that thing that which is totally human.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, very much so. But even in the city, as Merwin said when he was a child, he asked his mother walking on the sidewalk in New Jersey, you know, what's this, mother, you know, outside of the bricks and stone here? Oh, it's grass growing. Where does this grass come from? And she said to him, it grows underneath. It's underneath what we created, the blocks, the Euclidean designs that we've made. It's still there. It's still there.
Yeah, you know, and that works really well with the idea that if we take care of, go back, and restoration sometimes comes from within. It's already there. I was thinking about, we interviewed somebody several episodes ago about fire ecology out west. And one of the interesting things about that is, yes, there's huge loss and devastation. However, some things are just waiting in the ground for a fire to happen because it provides the right nutrients and the right heat for them to emerge. And so we don't have, as humans, I think, sometimes a complete understanding of that which lies there, not speaking, and then all of a sudden it's given voice.
Yeah, yeah, that's that intimate interdependence, that connectivity to everything. You affect one thing, you take out one species, and it breaks down the ecological system. We've seen that happen over and over again. In recent centuries, and it's just, you know, it's very sad, but we need to take hold of our reason and our passion for life, all life, and apply it.
Wow. I've been talking with our guest, Ron Fenn, about his poetry. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists and scientists and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others and with your family any of the ideas we're exploring in today's show, and we'll be right back.
This is Jürgen Jungbauer from the Heidelberg House on Pendleton Pike here in Indianapolis. Join me this Sunday for German Music Hour. And even if you don't speak the language, I hope you enjoy the music and the rhythm and the beat on this radio station every Sunday at 1 o'clock. It's only here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. Today I'm having a conversation with Ronald Harrison Fenn, sorry. And Ron, the amazing thing that you told me is that your name that you use for as a writer has your dad as your middle name, which I think is just really special and important. So I'm glad we were able to include Harrison in there. You're going to read another poem, and this is from Southwest kind of collection, right?
Yes.
So why don't you tell us a little about it and introduce it? And,
sure, Mark.
And then read it.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Last decade, I did five trips down to the American Southwest, and in that time did quite a bit of hiking with a fellow traveler and came back and put together a collection of Southwestern poems based on its place, people, and spirit that is there. And it is my American Southwest series, subtitled Desert Meditations. So I'd like to just take one of the poems, which integrates, I think people will pick up on it, both the spirit of that land in particular. What I hear most from people in audiences and so forth, they love the Southwestern readings I do because of its imagery. They say it's striking how it just reminded us of when we were there or in a certain area that I may have brought up before I read the poem. So here goes. This poem is called, and it shows how organic and connective we are. The title of it is Talking Clouds. Silvery gray underbelly turned to charcoal tints. High, cool, moist blanket weaved from nature's loom. A celestial fabric of a bluish gray cotton haze, drifting under layers of silver glint and open canvas of azure sky. So low to this desert country, over the Malpai mesas and buttes, loudscape suspended over the far horizon, tracking eastward, pushed by westward winds. With the hands of time almost silent and still, others near overhead casting down rambling shadows, afar an ominous gray mass drops vertical curtains of foreboding darkness, only to be illuminated by jagged bolts of lightning striking the four corners of earth and skies in brilliant flashes magnified. As aftermath of thunder rolls through this vast open space of earth and sky, an airborne quake erupts from this ice crystal laden nimbus mass. Into iron sheets of driving ice to rain. That smell of moisture mixed with dust on its downward path. Evaporate midair in their ghostly descent, this time bearing little treasure to a thirsty terrain. Populated by skyward beckoning arms of winterfat, choya, juniper, and grama grass. Clouds carry on in a language of their own, never promising their talking bounty to the denizens below. Yet in their time they shall converse, when speaking of rain they shall disperse.
You know, while we were sitting here and you had to take a pause just briefly because the sky kind of interfered with us with this wind, it's appropriate with this. And so you titled that one Talking Clouds, right?
Yes.
That makes me, again, that this theme seems to run through our conversation and through your poetry of that things speak to you. Things that we might not, you know, that are inanimate. And a lot of us, I think, are afraid to say that they hear things, because then they'd be thought of as being weird or crazy or whatever. Why do you think that is, that we get so afraid?
Well, I think in order to even try to approach that question, Mark, I'd first say what the poet does, as well as the writer in general, novelist and so forth, is to take things synesthetically. The idea is that grass talks. It talks in the wind. It's that connectivity. It's that personification. It's that illusion that we may take and apply it to some kind of fabulous alliteration that people would love to hear, and they sink into that. But then all of a sudden they listen to the words and they understand that the words are this unity that's coming about through this synesthetic experience, drawing in all the senses. And this is what the poet can do through imagination. You can use the senses in different way, where sound feels, sight hears.
Color reveals.
Color reveals, yeah. Exactly.
It's, you know, you're also giving me this really great sense of understanding poetry beyond what I thought I understood about it. And that is this idea that you are really in it. You're experiencing words, but it's more than that. In other words, it's creating, right? Those experiences are coming back.
Yes.
You know, so you talk about your Southwest stuff, then people get this idea that they've been there before or they know that place. Even that it might not be the same, but it evokes that. And so I love this transcendental move between words and back and forth between that and images that you create within your own mind.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, there are, if I may, there's two final poems.
Yeah, I'd love to have you do that.
If we have time.
Sure.
One is tied into exactly what you're saying, if I can find it. And let me see if it's up front here. It might be in my new collection. But I think you're right on that front, that we have to take what we experience and translate it with whatever means we need to. And if you could pardon me a second, and if you have any questions, I could answer it. And I'd like to find a particular poem to share with you.
That'd be great. Ron, go ahead and read that.
This poem, Mark, is titled Eulogy for a Red Fox. Cause of death to the red fox, I cannot say. In basking repose, spread still to the wind in pasture grass below. On cold winter day, along a lonely utility swathe, I, in my heading, walk west. She, uncorrupted, in form, pose, and sight. I know not her final plight. No markings of struggle, nor signatures of wounds from those who mortal prey. Coyote, raptor, disease, or man, or other way, I do not know. Her recessed, opalescent eyes and teeth glint in the stretch of afternoon sun within a steady train of death. Her breeze-tufted red coat as fire and ash as its sun, melding azure, secure sky and finality. Perhaps her end occasioned an old age has taken, or man's toxins claim. I know not, as witness to her grace and strength, transforming still in her living of death.
Oh, wow. Is that inspired by something you actually saw out here?
Yes it is. Yeah, it was on this winter walk, and it was along utility lines here. And just perfectly, the fox was posed, just spread right out, you know.
So wow.
Just perfect form, just as if she was being photographed.
How lovely.
Yeah, no corruption, No bites, no violent marks on her whatsoever.
She just passed.
Just passed. And there before me.
How beautiful. Yeah. You have another one you'd like to read.
Yeah, I'd like to finish with really what all comes to all of us, and that is a poem that went viral a couple years ago in my first collection. And it's titled, What Blooms Late. When the fires of spring and summer give way to those autumn and winter years, forbearance is the pace of life, rounded by the shocks of the unexpected. Not yet flat nor plain is the summer sun. A wizened wisdom blooms, finding the simple and the complex, seeing endings next to next. Every breath refrains its familiarity, like greeting an old friend. The routines of life become a sequence of simple awakenings, where a just-picked flower remains in the unforgotten realms of imagination. To harvest, to grasp the ends of life, becomes a sparing exercise, from the garden to the table.
Talk to me just briefly about the inspiration for that one.
Probably having to do with, my recent retirement, inability to continue full speed ahead with my poetry. And also a vision of life that we look at in, everything. And, we were talking about the inward-outward stroke of life. Well, the outward stroke of life is death. The inward stroke is birth. So so death is living. Death is part of the living experience. It's not absent of anything. It's not void of anything. And that's part of this intimate connectivity to the wisdom of integration of life itself. And a poet has that opportunity to bring it out in the words that come to me, or come to she and her writings, or my writings, anybody's writings. And it may come out in different forms to people. And for me, it is this glancing over the horizon that shows me that there is no beginning, no ending, as with the cycles of the seasons, as with this life on Earth. We so temporal, but in turn, we know from science, and this is one of the amazing facts of science, is the fact we know much more about the cosmological endings, so to speak, of this universe, and much more about it than we ever could have. We live in an amazing time, and it's just wonderful to be a part of this great renaissance in terms of science, art, meditation, community, and spirit, in terms of developing a better world.
Couldn't have said it more beautifully. I want to thank you, Ronald Harrison Fenn, for being our guest and for sharing your poetry particularly. And until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.